Good morning, everybody.
Thank you for coming to our weekend, where we're going to be discussing various things, the mind and the what we call cyclic existence or samsara, everything that comes from the mind. There are some notes that you have which have been extracted from one of the books that was mentioned that I've written. They're just a brief outline. I thought it'd be good to have them because there's quite a bit of information that I want to discuss. So if you have the outline, it'll help you to understand. So normally, before a Dharma talk, we would say some prayers in order to place our minds in a very appropriate attitude or state for engaging in the activity of discussing the Buddha Dharma. So we could say prayers, or we can, what I feel is probably a better way, is to meditate together. And as we've got quite a few sessions together, hour and a half this morning, then the afternoon, and then tomorrow, then let's begin by doing some simple meditation on our breath. And during the meditation, we'll establish our minds in a positive, constructive motivation for discussing Dharma this weekend. Excuse me for sitting in a chair, but with age, one's joints become a little bit frozen up, and my hips don't like sitting cross-legged for too long. So I'm obliged to make a concession to age and sit in a chair. Of course, Maitreya Buddha sits in a chair, but for an entirely different reason. It's said that he's shown to be sitting in a chair because it means he's ready to stand up and become the next wheel-turning Buddha to help sentient beings. I wish I could say that I were in a similar situation, but unfortunately, not yet. Okay. So, as I'm sure you've been instructed in the past to meditate, we first check our physical posture, make sure we try and feel comfortable, keep our back straight, rest the right hand and the left hand, thumbs together, hands in your lap. Keep your head just slightly angled forward and your eyes very slightly open or lightly closed, and breathing normally through the nose. Focus your whole attention on the sensation of the air as it enters and leaves the nostrils with each breath. So try to maintain a continuity of awareness of the coming and going of your breath without allowing your mind to be distracted by thoughts of anything else. Try to hold your attention on the coming and going of your breath. Now think that we are all equal, in that in our lives we simply wish to have peace and happiness and freedom from problems and pain and unhappiness. Not just humans, but every animal, every bird, every insect, every being reborn in other states has the same fundamental wish for peace and happiness and freedom from pain. Our society has evolved through individuals trying to establish those goals for self and for others. That no human society in all of history has ever achieved or even come close to the common goal of peace and happiness and freedom from suffering. And the Buddha explained why. We simply do not know the real causes of happiness and the real causes of unhappiness. We believe that the sources are outside, external, from our mind. And so we try to control the environment, each other, outer conditions. But our attempts are constantly frustrated, brief times of peace and happiness are quickly over as things change inevitably, or as we grow old. And most of us die with a sense of disappointment and having not achieved our ideals in life. Nevertheless, we invest our hopes in our children, and when that doesn't work out, we invest our hopes in our grandchildren, always believing somehow they can achieve the peace and happiness which we feel is possible, but we're not able to achieve it ourselves. The teachings of Buddha indicate that the real source of peace and happiness is internal in our own minds, and the real source of pain and unhappiness is also internal in our own minds. We cannot put the outer world into order, but we can put our own mind into order and achieve the happiness and peace that we instinctively know is possible. So each of us should think that this weekend I'm going to participate in the discussion on Buddhist teachings in order to learn how I can put my own mind into order to progress towards peace and happiness. And in this way, merely by example or by explanation, I can help guide others who depend upon me to achieving the same goal. So generate your mind in the aspect of universal love, wishing to make others happy and delighting in their happiness and freedom from pain. And let this be the pervading attitude to cultivate and maintain this weekend and for the remainder of your life. Now you can relax. So first I'd like to thank the management of Amitabha Buddhist Center for inviting me to Singapore to give some talks. Although I've been a monk for quite a long time now, maybe something like 44 years, I've been a very lazy monk, and I'm afraid I haven't done much meditation or gained any inner wisdom. But my teachers have asked me to, over the years, to give talks and share what I have learned, and so I'm happy to follow their instructions and be with you this weekend. From the very beginning, after I was ordained, my teacher, Lama Thubten Yeshe, he asked me to one day to write some book or to communicate Buddhist psychology to Western psychologists to make a connection. It's an ongoing process of mine, a job, and I think this weekend's topic and the discussion will involve many of the important points that have come to my mind. about psychology in terms of not theoretical psychology, but very fundamental information of how we can understand our own emotions, our own mind, and begin the process of training our mind in wisdom and in compassion, which is the spiritual path. So it begins with Buddha's, as in the notes, Buddha presented in a very simple way how things exist. There are existing things and there are non-existing things. So whatever exists can be known by mind. There are not mysteries in the universe which can never be understood. There are subtle things which we may not be able to understand until we approach Buddhahood. But in general, things can be understood when they're defined clearly. Now, before I met Buddhism, you know, my whole worldview was that of science, and still remains very much so. There's a difference in the approach between Buddhism and science. In science, we use terms like mind and space, and then we try to discover what they are. Still, in Western psychology, there is the term mind is used, but there's no definition of what it means. And so many different psychologists, psychiatrists, they have different idea of what they're talking about when they use a term mind, so fundamental. And space too, physicists use the term space, but they have no idea what it, they don't have a definition of space. Therefore, it evolves. The understanding is approaching something, but because no two individuals really have a commonly agreed upon description or of the meaning of the term space, then it becomes very vague. In fact, I'm reading a book on quantum physics at the moment, and I'm totally lost in what space is from the scientific point of view, as is the writer, who at the end says, I think this is what space and the other things he's talking about, what they are, but I'm not sure. So, I mean, it's a reasonable approach, but it's not clear. Buddha was so clear in the beginning. He said, this is how things exist. So, whatever exists belongs to one of two categories. There's a category of things which change moment by moment, and things which don't change moment by moment. So, all existing things and one of those two categories. In our translation into English, we use the term permanence for things which don't change moment by moment. Permanent sort of has the connotation of lasting forever and ever and ever. But the point is, permanent things can come to an end, but during their existence, they don't have this change, this subtle moment by moment change. So, the impermanent things do. In fact, the book on quantum physics that I'm reading strongly presents that point. Whatever exists in the physical realm is constantly changing moment by moment. No, this is not Buddhism, this is nuclear quantum physics. No phenomenon exists in its own right of itself. And also, the conclusion, is that everything exists in dependence upon something else, in comparison or in relation to something else. Even time exists in dependence upon relation to your location and something else, but not in its own right. This is a fantastic realization from quantum physics. This is the fundamental teaching of Buddha, of how changing things exist. But what's missing in the quantum physics book is the implication of belief that things do exist from their own side, in their own right, independent of other things. That belief, initially in relation to our own self, we all are born with the belief that there is a real, true me here, somewhere within the body and mind. We don't pinpoint it, but we have the belief that I am I am here. And that's, whenever we think I, that's how our self appears to our mind. So, nuclear physics, quantum physics, is no such thing. Everything is relative. Nothing exists in its own right. And then they close the book and go home for dinner. The point is that wrong conception that I and mum and dad and brother and sister and everything and objects, everything exists in its own right, independent of something else. That is the root, that belief is the root cause of all unhappiness. That belief pushes away the happiness and peace that we want. So, this is the point that Buddha made. When I say, we all believe, no, the causes of pleasure are out there. The perfect partner, the perfect job, the perfect wealth and house and career, you know, all of these things out there to be acquired. And the causes of unhappiness are the nasty people, the nasty situations, nasty weather, which exists out there. So we go into battle against the environment. We go into battle against other people, other societies, believing that, no, that political system, that is the cause of suffering and unhappiness, and that has to be eliminated. Completely wrong. The real cause is internal in our own mind. And our own mind is accessible. The history of human society is one of conflict. It is one of, you know, social systems rising, relative peace, but not total peace, and then falling. Political doctrines rising and falling. Constant change. And even if internally society doesn't self-destruct, then there are geological changes in Australia. Australia is burning right now. Incredible. I just received an email this morning. A friend, she's a doctor working in New South Wales on the coast. The people she worked with already, some have lost their houses and their animals. And today, it's going to be 43 degrees where she lives. And strong wind, and it's so dry. It's frightening. So these environmental changes can destroy anything. How to deal with it is very difficult if we don't understand. When we lose all that we've invested our whole life into to make happiness, not only our property, but husbands and wives and children are being killed by the fires. Careers. And so it's not only is it externally devastating, but it's internally devastating, because those poor individuals who are affected have no answer. Their whole life suddenly seems meaningless. What to do? That inner despair is greater suffering than the outer pain. So, this can happen anytime, anywhere. It does happen. And if we don't have, and our death is approaching, naturally, anyway, and if we're not prepared to deal with the situation when it starts to happen, again, all that we've done in our life starts to appear meaningless. The wealth we've accumulated, our reputation, our circle of friends, family, nothing can help. But we've invested all of our life into ordering the external things for peace and happiness. But none of these things, not only can they not help as we sink into illness and death, but we become more distressed as we're leaving everybody behind. Our collections of things, all that we work for, we're separating. We don't know where we're going. And so, once again, the inner psychological distress is far greater than the outer loss. Anyway, this is why Buddha had such great love and compassion, having recognized the reality of the mind and the mind's influence on our happiness, unhappiness, our life, how important it was to explain this to others, and how fortunate we are that so many great practitioners from the time of Buddha have maintained the transmission of the teachings of Buddha in India, in Tibet, in Southeast Asia, in north in Mongolia, and so on. These teachings spread and were practiced, and so many benefited. When we think about it, the teachings aren't that difficult to understand. They're very logical. But to put them into practice, we have to overcome our conditioned way of thinking, our self-centered way of thinking. And that's really hard. Because it's not just this life that we've been living under mistaken ideas of what we are as individuals and how to get happy and how to be free from suffering. Since beginningless time, this mind, which we call my mind, has strongly held those beliefs, those views. And so we weren't born with a mind which was a clean slate. Our mind brought with it so many thoroughly ingrained preconceptions about self and reality. And to overcome those preconceptions and internalize the Dharma, to change your mind, is difficult. Our mind resists. We place our whole self-image, our self-confidence, our whole purpose for life upon these mistaken concepts. That we're, not only were we born with them, but they've been reinforced during life by society. Not brainwashing, you know, or deliberate indoctrination. It's just that everybody has a mistaken view. And others do it, and we see the, you know, we're fed the films and so on television, and we see stories of others, and then advertising agencies insist, my product is real happiness, you must buy my product. And we believe it. Again, I don't think it's a malignant intention to utilize our preconceptions. It's just the way it is. Advertising, oh, people think like this, well, let's exploit it. Let's sell our product before somebody else's. But our preconceptions make us very vulnerable, very open to exploitation, not just by advertising agencies. As little children, we know how to exploit our parents' emotions. We know how to manipulate mum and dad to get what we want, with the right smile, the right attitude. And this manipulation becomes more refined as we grow up, and we manipulate each other. Our misconceptions. So, that's the way it is. All right. Now, we're going back to our presentation of things which exist. Two categories. There are things which change moment by moment, and things which don't change moment by moment. Now, there are just two examples that we talk about. There are many things which don't change moment by moment, but the commonest example is given as space in Buddhism. Now, space has its definition. So we're not talking about the physical space that quantum physics talks about. From the quantum physics point of view, actually, space is material. We'll leave that aside. The defining characteristic of what we call space in Buddhism is the mere absence of obstructive contact. That is what space is, which means that where there is space, there is no obstruction. Things can move through that region. Very simple. We know that this Earth is spinning on an axis. We know the Earth is you know, rotating around the Sun. We know that the whole solar system is spinning around the center of the Milky Way galaxy, and we know that the Milky Way galaxy is speeding through space at an incredible rate, you know, expanding. There is so much movement which we're really unaware of. When we see the morning and the afternoon and the evening, we realize, oh, there is something happening. And the ancient times, we thought the sun moved around the earth. But it's not like that. So, my point is that even this room is in a totally different space where probably thousands of kilometers away from where we were at 10:30. Because there's space. The mere absence of obstruction. You say, well, and space pervades everywhere. You say, well, there's no space here because I can't put my finger through the cup. But there is space because otherwise the cup couldn't be there. And this cup, like you and I, is doing all those motions. So that's simple. That definition of space, we don't need mathematical formulae. This quantum physics is unbelievable mathematics to indicate space, you know. It's just something very logical. So that doesn't change moment by moment. All right? Now, during these discussions, you're welcome at any time to put up your hand and say, you're wrong. Or ask any question. Please do. I said to the group on New Year's Day that when I was in Taiwan, and I was teaching there for 2 years, and my teacher, my translator was Huang Xunru, who you may have met. She was here. She did the gold gilding of the Chenrezig statue. She told me that in all her years in high school and university, she had never asked a teacher a single question because it wasn't done culturally. So we've got to ask questions. And Buddha said, don't accept what I say just because I'm who I am. You must question. You must check up. You must think about it and see how this information fits with your own experience. All right. So, space, is that okay? The mere absence of obstruction. When the mere absence of obstructive contact, that the mere means that space is not some entity in its own right. There's not some stuff which is space. Mere means there is nothing affirmed to be space in its own right. It's not some stuff, something. Which the quantum physicists haven't quite got onto yet, but they will when they get a definition. Now, that they have their definition, but what they call space is something entirely different. It's something physical, actually. Okay. Another thing which doesn't change moment by moment is our own ultimate nature, our emptiness of inherent existence. So this is what we are unaware of, that our own I, whenever we think I, and we, even whilst we're still in our mother's womb, you know, the fetus wakes up and it has a sense of me. Where am I? What's going on? So there's a sense of self appears to the fetus's mind still in the womb. And when the fetus thinks I, there appears, through conditioning from past lives, there appears to be a real, true I in that little fetal body, in body and mind. A real, true me existing in my own right. So the thought I, even in a fetus's mind, is referring to something which exists. It is a person. It does have a self. And when we think I, whether we're in the womb or here and now, you know, if somebody rings up and says, let's meet and have lunch together at such and such restaurant, We think, yes, I will meet you there. The I that we are referring to and the other person who we will meet, they exist. That is the conventional person. But what is appearing to our mind is a real true me, a me in my own right, will meet my friend who exists in his or her own right. You know, something more than the body and mind which bears my friend's name. A real entity, the friend, who exists within that body and mind. That's the mistake. Do you understand? So when we say I, we refer to the I that exists, but what we apprehend is an I which doesn't exist. So when we... So the I which exists is the conventional, merely labeled I. The I which doesn't exist is a real, true me, independent, existing in my own right. Now, our conventional nature is that merely labeled I. Our the ultimate nature of the self is that the conventional I is empty of existing in the way we think we exist. It doesn't mean that there is no me who will meet my friend at the restaurant. It means that there is no inherent me, inherently existing me. In other words, the ultimate nature of the self is emptiness of inherent existence. That exists. That emptiness has always existed. And it's not just the self. The cup, the room, whatever exists is empty of existing in its own right. That is the ultimate nature of all things when we talk about emptiness. Is that clear? Question? All right. So it is an existing thing. And it's not something which changes moment by moment. It is just a reality of the eye or of the cup that doesn't change moment. It is just constant. It can come to an end. If I smash the cup, the emptiness of the cup stops. It began when the cup came out of the kiln, you know, it was made by a potter and heated up, and the clay was just clay at one stage, and the clay has become something entirely different, the porcelain. So when the potter took it out of the kiln, said, this is a cup, at that moment, the conventional cup came into existence, independent upon the name cup. And at that time, the emptiness of cup came into existence. The object was empty of inherent existence before, but it wasn't called cup. It was only called cup when the potter said, this is a cup. And the same with us. Whatever our name is, English name, John, right? Parents, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, have a baby, and that baby is called Baby Smith. Then, after some time, Mum and Dad say, let's call him John. Right, with that mental decision to call their baby John, at that moment, the person, John Smith, came into existence. John Smith, well, this particular John Smith, probably many John Smiths, this particular John Smith did not exist prior to the moment the parents gave it the name. There was Baby Smith, but it wasn't John Smith. Same with us. And at that time, the emptiness of John Smith came into existence. All right. So the ultimate nature, emptiness, does not change moment by moment. So that's the first category. That's just two examples, space and emptiness, of the first category of existing things. The second category is impermanent things, things which change moment by moment. And there are three members of this category. And everything's included in these three members. The first is physical things. Or in Buddhist terminology, we use the term form. The form refers to matter, physical things. So the whole physical world, changing moment by moment. As quantum physics asserts, they totally agree with us. They also, quantum physics totally agrees that all things are empty of inherent existence. But as I said before, they don't realize the import of such an observation, that grasping at things as existing inherently is the root of all suffering. And realizing that in particular, that the I does not exist inherently, is the root of all happiness. It's the door to liberation from samsara, from the wheel of life. When I'm reading this book, I think, oh, if only I could tell this man to read something about Buddhism. But that's the thing, that the lamas have said, even a lecturer in Buddhist philosophy can explain that the I and all things are empty of inherent existence. Intellectually, they know it. But they do not understand what the grasping at an inherently existing me is, how it manifests in the mind. They still live in this false world of projecting inherent existence on self and others. They still get angry, they still get attached, they still get proud, jealous, and so on. So there's a great difference in inner knowledge born out of meditation on reality and intellectual knowledge. It doesn't mean that intellectual knowledge should be thrown out the window. And there are some Buddhist schools which believe that intellectual knowledge is an obstacle to seeing reality, and therefore reject intellectualization. That's a mistake. Yes, in understanding reality, we do need to go deeper than intellectual understanding. But to get there, to get to that deep meditative awareness, we have to overcome our mistaken ideas, our completely wrong conceptions. And the only way that can happen is through correct conceptions, correct intellectual understanding. Then we really know the wrong appearance and the correct view. And then in meditation, yes, the intellectual understanding, we break through for inner realization. Okay. We keep coming back to emptiness. Important subject. So, physical things, changing moment by moment. Then, all mental things, consciousness and mind, are synonyms. So, mind is a continuum of awareness, the subjective experience of things. And we have subjective experience of the outer world in dependence upon our five senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching. So when our sense organs are functioning, we are aware of the various types of sense object. The sixth sense in Buddhism we call mental consciousness. And that is the realm of our knowledge, our memories, our understanding, our giving names to things, and so on. So, in general, our mind is a continuum of awareness. If we break that down to different types of awareness, the five senses and mental consciousness. So when our mind in general is operating, we are experiencing the world through various senses, and then we're thinking about. So that information goes to the sixth sense, the mental consciousness, which thinks about that which we are physically experiencing, and goes into ideas and plans and fantasies. So much activity happens in the mental consciousness. Dreams are all mental consciousness. The buildings, rocket ships, cars, all the objects which we create are first created in the form of ideas, knowledge, and plans, all happening in mental consciousness. So we're going to talk about mind in more detail, but this is just in general. Each moment of awareness is changing. Awareness is changing moment by moment. There's no such thing as a state of mind which remains constant. We see something attractive, then during that period we're watching, even there is subtle change, and then it stops, or the object changes, and so the subjective experience is changing moment by moment. Mind is a sequence of short moments of awareness, one giving rise to the next, but always changing. It's like you have a film strip. You take a strip of film, and each frame looks the same. If you just hold it up like that. Because when it goes through the projector, you get movement because they go through very fast, or apparent movement. But we know that each frame, if we really check up, there's a slight difference. And that's because when it's projected, you get the movement. So mind is like that. Constant change from one frame to the next frame to the next frame. So that's the second type of impermanent phenomenon. The third, so we've had forms, we've had mind or consciousness. The third is things which are produced, or products, which are changing moment by moment, but they're neither form nor mind. They're neither physical nor mental. And there are two major categories. Here, the first is persons. You are something which is, you are neither your body, nor are you your mind. Nor are you an entity which exists in your own right, totally independent of body and mind. That would be inherent existence. I mentioned in Australia, I was giving a talk a few weeks ago, and I mentioned this category of things which exist but are neither physical nor mental. And a lady asked me, can you give me an example of something which exists but is neither physical nor mental? And I said, yes, you. You exist, but you're neither physical nor mental. So how is this? Well, we talked about the baby John Smith, there was a newborn baby called Baby Smith. Right? John Smith did not exist, but there was a body and mind in the cot, wherever it was. And then Mum and Dad said, let's call this our baby John. So John Smith came into existence, the person John Smith. But the body wasn't John Smith, and the mind inside that body was not John Smith. The label John Smith isn't John Smith, isn't the person. But John Smith exists. How? Independence. John Smith, the person, exists independence upon the label, John, and that which is labeled the body and mind. And everybody, they see Mr. and Mrs. Smith, they say, oh, you've got a new baby. Is it a boy or a girl? That's usually the first question. So, oh, it's a boy, or it's a girl, according to its body. Oh, what's its name? John. Ah, John. So I know the person, this new baby, John. But neither the body nor mind. If the body and mind were already John, the parents wouldn't have had to give a name. This baby would have been John Smith when it was born from its side. But no. It's John, the person John, from the side of the name and that which is name. So, you think about it. Not just persons, but everything exists independent upon a label given to a basis. We categorize physical things and mental things in their own group because physical things have, you know, they're composed of physical matter, and mental things are composed of awareness. But persons, and so physical things are merely labeled, and mental things are also merely labeled on a base. But persons, there is no stuff which is a person, no entity at all. But they exist. Conventionally, John Smith exists from the time Mum and Dad give the name, and from the remainder, whenever this person is introduced, here's John. Ah, that's John. And we sign our name, John Smith, and like a photograph. Oh, that's John Smith, but of course, it's not the image, it's not the body, but that is suitable. That face in the photograph is suitable to be called John Smith because we have prior knowledge. Other people who have no idea who the person's photograph is would not know that's John Smith. It's only those who were informed, who knew beforehand John Smith, so they can identify John Smith in a photograph. Say, so that's John Smith. But of course, it's not. That is, that face is suitable to be called John. Very important point. Yes. Yeah. They are both. Yeah. Well, we can say that this is a physical thing because it's composed of atoms and molecules. And, you know, that is like the underlying substance of the cup. And mind is composed of awareness, in moments of awareness. So that's the underlying substance, if you like, of consciousness or mind. But the person, there is no physical composition which is the person. Our bodies are merely the food that we've and drink that we've had. When I was in high school, I think I was taught that every 7 years our body totally, every cell changes. They're constantly being built up and broken down and excreted. So this body is just the transformation of the food and drink and air we've breathed. It's not me. And the mind is constantly, the eyes are constantly seeing different things, hearing, smelling, tasting, emotions changing, knowledge changing. There's nothing within all this awareness which is the person, me. So no, we can't say that the person is both body and mind. It is neither body or mind. Right. Oh, good question. Good to think about. But people think, no, I'm here. You know, we really want to cling to this idea of the real me. Yeah. Where is our mind? Ah, another good question. Mind is not physical, right? So we can talk about physical things. Where's the cup? The cup's on the table. The mala is on the table. But mind, not having any physical characteristics, cannot really be given a physical location. Well, yeah, we'll come to the scientific idea of mind. In the Abhidhamma, Buddha taught that mind pervades the whole body except for the hair, well, I haven't got any, the hair and the fingernails and toenails, which means that our whole body is associated with our human consciousness in general. There can be times through the power of meditation when mind can be separate from the body. I know you may have heard the terms like astral body. Through the power of meditation, the mind can actually be separate from the body. But you can say it's there or there. It's where it knows. Anyway, the Abhidhamma says, in general, the human mind, normal human mind, is related to the entire body except hair and fingernails and toenails. Okay. So, we're talking about impermanent things, things which change moment by moment. There's category of physical things, category of consciousness or mind, and the category of things which are produced, but they're neither body nor mind. And that has two divisions, persons, and all actually persons aren't just humans. Every sentient being, every being who has mind, you know, within the what we call sentient beings, is a person. So your people who have dogs and cats, you already know that your dog or cat is a person. But so is the cockroach on the kitchen floor, and the mosquitoes, and the snakes and worms, and the beings in other realms of existence, they're persons. Even a Buddha is a person, special person. We don't call a Buddha a sentient being, because a Buddha has sort of, they have body and mind, but they are persons who are totally free from the wheel of life. Okay, so persons, and then things which are neither persons, or which are not persons. So what examples I've got here. There's something called life, right? Life exists, doesn't it? If we weren't alive, we'd be dead. So life is something which exists. So is death. But what is life? What is death? What is change? Change is something which exists. But it's not physical. It's not mental. Physical things change. Mental things change. But they are not the phenomenon of change. But change exists, so change belongs to this category. As does life, and cessation or death, and time. This is something, again, where Buddhism defines time as, you know, the observed passage from past to present to future. We label that time. We observe the daylight and night, and we call that day and this night, and then we divide the day up into 24 hours and each hour into 60 minutes and then 60 seconds. It is purely, we designate, we observe change, and we, on top of that change, we label year, month, week, day, hour, minute, second. So they are, time is merely imputed upon the observed change from past to present to future. Very simple. Again, the quantum physics book has a whole different... Actually, at the final chapter of the book I'm reading, the writer, he agrees. Time does not exist in its own right. Time is just a convention, Isaac Newton and other great physicists, Einstein, incorporated time into their equations, but that does not give time any substantial existence. Okay, I won't go any more into that one. But time exists. Merely something designated by mind upon the observed passage, past to present to future. There's nothing that's time in its own right. Okay, so there are other members of this category, like number, and even region. Like we can say, this region is seaside. This region is mountainous. This region is plain, and so on. So those regions exist, but there's nothing which is seaside in itself. There's nothing which is mountain or mountainous in itself. There's nothing which is plain in itself. Okay. So, that is the first important topic for this weekend, to categorize everything that exists as being something which is either unchanging, permanent, which is changing. If it's changing, it's one of those three categories. So whatever exists fits there. And we're going to go into more detail about mind and then the three realms of birth, so according to the notes which you have. So, we have a few minutes left. Is there any more discussion on these particular points? Yeah.
So are there only two examples
No, many. Well, when we change itself, not the concept of change, but change itself by definition is change. Because change is given to things which we observe, like physical and mental things which we see are changing. They have this quality of change. So the phenomenon of change, or its very name, is changing. The concept, now that's something else. All concepts, every concept, a concept is an idea. It's a thought of something. Whenever we think of something, not only are we thinking of the object, but we have a mental picture, a mental image of what we're thinking about. So, if you think of, or anything, your own self or your mother, your father, when I say think of your mother, then your thought is referring to your actual mother. But what is, if we really check up, there's an inner picture, an image of our mother associated with that concept. That mental image does not change moment by moment. That is another example of a permanent thing. It comes into existence when we start thinking about mother, and it ceases when we stop thinking about mother. But during the sequence of moments of thinking about mother, there is an unchanging mental image of mother. So yes, the concept does not change, but the object conceived changes. And what we're talking about, the objects, we're not talking about the ideas of object. Is that okay? Oh, yeah. Sorry? Yeah. Love, compassion, anger. They are states of mind. They are concepts, and concepts are mind, and mind changes moment by moment. See, the image of mother is not mind. It is a permanent, unchanging thing that's happening when mind is thinking of mother. So the concept of mother is mind. But what appears to that idea of is the mental image of mother, that is not mind. That is the appearing object. The referent object is mother. Love is the mental attitude of delighting in the happiness of another, right? And wishing to make another happy. So that is mind. That is a conception in the mind. Anger is the opposite. Anger is an agitated state of mind which wishes another to be hurt or to, you know, get rid of the object of anger. So anger is mind, is called a mental factor. This will come tomorrow in great detail. But those things, love, anger, jealousy, compassion, are states of mind and they change moment by moment. Yeah. Permanent things
can come to an end.
Yeah. Yeah.
So space can be
is to have a beginning and an end. The point is that, say, the emptiness of the cup begins when the cup is created and it ends when the cup is destroyed. But during the time that there is a conventional cup, its nature of emptiness is not changing moment by moment. Why does Buddha talk about permanent and impermanent? Well, there's many reasons, but for something, causality. This comes down to Buddha's teaching on causality. Nothing happens by chance. Everything that exists, exists in dependence upon something else. And impermanent things, there is, because the clay has the moment by moment change, when you change the conditions, you get a potter to spin the shape, and you get the heat of the kiln. When you change the conditions, because clay is an impermanent thing, it can change into porcelain. If clay did not have the quality of changing moment by moment, no matter how much you heat it, it won't become porcelain. The porcelain also is changing moment by moment. It has the characteristic of change from its substantial cause, the clay. Does that cover the question? Well, yeah, there's causality. And this comes into play when we talk about karma. The karma is a cause and effect sequence, that there is no such thing as happiness arising without a cause. No such thing as pain or sadness arising without a cause. And there is causes and there are conditions. So we believe that the conditions are the primary cause. That no, it is the person out there that I love and I want that person to love me. That then my happiness comes from that person admiring me, praising me, loving me. So I can't be happy unless this person reciprocates my affection for them. Right? Impossible. And if we reject it, we commit suicide. Because we think we can only be happy if that person loves me. So sad. I mean, that's an extreme example, but it's not uncommon. Okay. All right. So maybe we could stop for now and we can have lunch and we'll continue after lunch. There's quite a lot to talk about, actually, that I've got tomorrow as well. So in this morning's session, I've spent a lot of time establishing the ground upon which the latter discussion will depend. So enjoy lunch, but remember, it's causal. And I'll see you after lunch. Thank you.